from his mouth and nose. Lucifer was disgusted. There was no defiance now, no vanity of self. The witness was broken. A witless corpse, too lost in pain to know that it was dead. There remained just one thing left to do, to shroud the witness in his funeral garb and to take from him the breath of life, the breath that had given voice to his lies. Lucifer went and bought a shroud, and when the witness saw it, he found the strength to recoil in a final gesture of horror. His eyes stared, and he squirmed away like something that lived in the earth. But Lucifer took a step and knelt beside him and placed the shroud over his head, pulling it down the length of his body until he was enclosed. Steve slowed as he approached the buildings. There were no lights on in the house, no sign of life at all, and no sign of the black Mercedes van. Could he have got it wrong? Could there be more than one house with a large pylon standing beside the drive? Please God, he thought, please God. He padded into the yard, house to the left, a large barn straight ahead, and several stone-built outhouses to the right. This had once been a working farm. Steve looked around. But for the light of a gibbous moon, it would have been too dark to see. He approached the barn, but it was locked. He tried to peer in through cracks at the side, but the moon's light did not extend that far. The sense of despair returned as the fear that he might be at the wrong place took hold. This has to be the place, he told himself. It has to be. He started towards the house, but just as he turned away from the barn, something caught his attention. The trees surrounding the outhouses seemed to be faintly illuminated by something other than the pale light of the moon. There was another source of light. Steve started towards the stone buildings to the right. Two of them were simple sheds, but one of them looked like an old grain store, a large, circular building, built from undressed stone. Something in Steve's memory pricked up at this, something that Simon had said, something about an old stone church with circular walls. Steve's heart rate quickened as he approached the peculiar old building. And when he reached the arch wooden door, he knew. There was a large black cross in the door and a thin crack of light at its base. Someone was inside. In the pallid gloom, Steve looked to see if there was a lock. There was. But he could see by the way the door was lying that the lock was not engaged. Steve put his eye to the keyhole, church pews in candlelight, an altar, and wait. Someone crouching down before it. A priest or an altar boy dressed in a black robe and a filthy white surcoat. But this was no priest or servant of the church. The figure stood, and in doing so revealed itself in all its size. Few men cut such a form at such a scale. Steve had found the killer. But was Simon still alive? Simon was utterly helpless. Panic fluttered in his mind like the wings of a trapped bird, while his heart beat out the meter of his death. No, he thought, not yet. You can't, please, no. And he had no breath for words, only breath for fear, fear in panting gasps that drew the plastic against his face and blew it away in a transparent misty veil. Lucifer stood up from the witness and went to get the hose. He bent to make sure that one end was properly attached to the pump. Then he grabbed the other and took a plastic tie to secure the shroud. He did not hear the tiny click of iron as a latch was raised with utmost care. He returned to the witness and pushed the hose up into the shroud. He did not hear the slow scrape of wood on stone or the faint complaint of a rusty hinge. He gathered the shroud together around the witness's ankles and secured it with a plastic tie. He did not hear the stealthy footfalls on the flagstones of the chapel. But when he stood, he felt the movement in the air. And when he turned to look, he saw the angel standing there. Steve froze as the killer's eyes fell upon him, but he did not shrink in fear. He met the malice in those dead black eyes, and when he spoke, his voice was calm and steady and weighted with a promise of violence. Where is he? Steve demanded. By way of an answer, the killer looked down at his feet, and when he looked up, he raised his arms as if to say, "Behold." Steve looked down to the shape lying at the killer's feet, a large, clear polythene bag with something pale inside. At first, he did not see it for what it was, but then, feeling suddenly sick, he did. "Simon!" he cried, taking an involuntary step forward down the aisle. The killer stepped over Simon's body, coming to stand protectively before his prize. Steve's eyes flicked from the killer to the obscene shape of Simon's naked body in the bag. "He's dead. Oh, God, he's dead." But then the bag moved, and Steve heard a quiet, pitiful moan. "Alive," thought Steve, the relief sweeping through his mind. "He's alive." But for how long? The bag was tied around his ankles, and Steve knew that he could not survive for long on the air that remained inside the bag. He had to get him out, and quick. But first, he had to get past the killer. Steve looked up at the killer and saw his eyes shift to the side of the chapel, to what looked like a small generator or pump. There was a black hose connected to the pump, and Steve's eyes followed it as it snaked across the floor. The other end had been pushed between Simon's feet up into the bag. Steve frowned at the killer's depravity, then looked at him once more. For a second, the two men held each other's gaze. And then, as if at some unspoken command, they started towards each other. Steve moved in slow, measured steps, while the killer came on more quickly, enraged that the angel was here in this most sacred place. Steve let him come, this mountain of a man, and when he reached for him, Steve moved with lightning speed. He caught the killer's arm, took a handful of his dirty robes, and swiveled at the waist, using the killer's own momentum as he threw him over his hip. The killer's feet crashed into the wooden pews as Steve slammed him down against the hard stone floor. With his left hand, he kept hold of the killer's robes, holding him down while he punched him in the face. It was like punching a boulder, but he did it again and again, searching for that perfect blow that would do some real damage. But the killer was not so easily subdued. He let out an animal growl and grabbed hold of Steve's clothes, and Steve witnessed his terrible strength as he was hurled aside. The killer came quickly to his feet, but Steve was quicker. Before the killer had risen fully to his feet, Steve launched a scissor kick and rammed his heel into the killer's jaw. The hefty kick rocked the killer, and he swayed on one knee, unable to stand. Steve closed quickly, broke his nose with a solid punch, then hammered his elbow into the killer's face. The killer's arms reached out blindly for Steve, blood pouring from his nose, his mouth, and a cut above his eye. Then his eyes rolled back, and he collapsed heavily to one side. Steve raced to Simon's side. "Not too late," he prayed. "Please, not too late." He knelt down beside his friend and paused for just an instant at the awful sight. Simon's body was covered in blood and bruises, his face misshapen, his eyes flickering as the air in the bag turned bad, poisoned by his own exhalations. Steve went to his ankles, tried to break the plastic tie and tug the plastic free. He could do neither. He grabbed the bag near Simon's face and tried to tear it with his hands, but it was industrial-strength polythene and simply would not tear. He pulled out the hose and tugged at the bag, drawing air through the narrow gaps at Simon's ankles, and he saw Simon gulping down a breath as the small amount of air in the bag was replenished. "Hang on, Simon," he said. "Hang on, I'll get you out of there." Steve looked round for something to cut or tear the heavy plastic. He did not see the warning look in Simon's eyes. He did not see the vast shape of a man rising from the chapel floor. Steve put his teeth to the polythene, but still it proved too strong. Then, car keys, he thought. He put his hand in his pocket and pulled out his keys. He had just managed to single out the sharp metal rod of the car key when the killer fell upon him. Steve felt like he'd been hit by a falling tree as the killer brought a massive fist down across his back. He collapsed onto the floor beside Simon, winded and dazed. Then he was lifted from the stone as the killer kicked him in the side. The kick cracked several of Steve's ribs, and he groaned with pain as he got up on his hands and knees. Then the killer strode up next to him and kicked Steve in the face, sending him flailing back against the altar. Stars and black blotches swam in Steve's vision as he clawed at the great marble altar, trying in vain to stand, but the killer came up behind him and punched him in the small of his back, then hammered a massive fist down at the base of Steve's neck. This would have been enough to finish most men, but Steve Brennus was not most men, and he tried again to stand. With a sneer of disdain, the killer reached down and took hold of the smaller man. He hooked one of Steve's arms in the crook of his elbow and placed his huge hands behind Steve's head. Then he began to squeeze. Steve grunted as the killer lifted him from the floor. His left arm was pinned, and he thought his neck would break with the force of the killer's hold. He flailed about with his free arm, but there was no way of reaching back at the killer. Then, looking down, he saw a small push knife on the altar. The knife was out of reach, but not so a large brass candlestick. As his breathing grew ever more constrained, Steve reached out and grabbed hold of the candlestick. The thick candle fell away, and Steve used the empty stick to try and reach the knife. He got the lip of the candlestick behind it and drew it closer and closer yet, but just as he was about to pull it within reach, the killer jerked him up. The knife was sent clattering away to the foot of the altar. Rage and frustration surged through Steve, and with a final effort, he lifted his feet, placed them against the altar, and shoved with all his might. The killer stumbled back, taking Steve with him. He lost his footing on the small step at the base of the altar, and the two men came crashing down into the pews at the front of the chapel. The corner of the pew caught Steve squarely on the temple and knocked him out cold. Lucifer rose unsteadily to his feet. He wiped the blood from his shattered nose and looked down at the body of the angel. He was not dead, but he soon would be. They both would, the angel and the witness. Lucifer spat a bloody mouthful across his fallen adversary. He bent down over the witness and pushed the hose back into the bag, then walked somewhat drunkenly to the side of the church. He lifted the thick brass crozier from the stand and moved along to the pump. It was time to take back the breath of life from the witness. Mindful of the ceremony that was not yet concluded, Lucifer offered up the briefest of prayers before he flicked the switch. Steve tried to blink his vision into focus. Simon lay before him. The polythene bag misted with condensation. He was still alive. Just. As if in a dream, Steve raised himself up and crawled towards Simon, fumbling at the polythene, trying to work a few more mouthfuls of breathable air into the bag. His senses were dulled, his mind foggy with concussion, but when Steve saw the push knife lying not 3 feet away, his body found the strength to make a final lunge. Steve's fist closed on the handle of the knife and he settled it in his palm. But when he turned back to look at Simon, he was horrified to see the polythene bag shrinking in against him, the slick material drawing tight around his body as all the air was sucked from it. Steve crawled towards Simon, but before he could reach him, the killer struck him down. Lucifer struck the angel with a rod. Then he hooked it under his chin and across his throat. Let him watch as the witness dies. Let him watch as the breath of life is taken back. Let him watch and let them die together. The chorus rose up in glorious exultation. Lucifer had prevailed against the witness and against the angel, against Providence itself. Those in dominion were pleased. He was the vessel of their righteousness, the instrument of their wrath. He was their servant, and they his gods. Steve watched as Simon suffocated before his eyes, right there in front of him, just out of arm's reach. He watched, but he could not move. The killer held the bar across his throat. He had managed to get his left hand under the bar, but despite this, the killer was slowly throttling the life out of him. Simon looked up at him, his grey eyes bulging with fear. his mouth gaping wide for the breath it could not take. The plastic stretched tight across his bluing lips. Steve reached forward with a knife in his hand. If he could just make a few more inches and pierce the membrane over Simon's mouth. But he could not reach. He strained and strained, but he could not reach. Then, in one last gesture of aggression, he stabbed the knife into the killer's hand. And then, as the killer relaxed his grip, Steve lunged forward, stabbing out with the knife. But just as he did so, the killer snatched him aside and Steve's aim went astray. Instead of stabbing the knife into the gaping hole of Simon's mouth, Steve stabbed him in the face. "No!" cried Steve as he felt the blade slice through flesh and bone.
"You stabbed me in the face with a short-bladed knife."
"No, Simon, no," he cried as the killer struck the knife from his hand and hauled him back, dragging him away from Simon so that he could no longer see his friend, the friend that he had killed. The killer pulled harder on the bar across Steve's throat. His wrist was the only thing preventing his windpipe from being crushed. But even with the killer squeezing the life out of him, Steve thought not of himself, but of the young man dying behind him.
"I'm sorry, Simon," he thought, as the darkness claimed him. "I'm sorry."
Chapter 32. There was an eternal moment of nothingness, in which nothing existed and nothing did. And then Simon took a breath, and the universe exploded into life. He woke into a world of pain. He woke into a world of pain, but not of fear. He had passed through the valley, through the shadows of death, and now he need fear no evil. The worst of all his fears had come to pass, and it had passed. For all the pain that racked his body, Simon's mind was clear. It shone, it burned, and Simon opened his eyes. He looked like a bag of pummeled meat. A grisly, horrible sight. Simon trembled from the cold and the pain, but he fought against his tortured body and tried to turn. The plastic bag restricted his movements. His body was beaten and cut and spattered with raw wounds where the acid had eaten away his skin, and inching round was an exercise in agony, but still he turned. He turned to see the man who had saved his life. The short knife had gouged into his cheek, just below his eye. It had sliced down through his upper lip and taken out a tooth, but it had cut through the suffocating plastic and let the air rush in. Simon gulped it down, and his body tingled with agonizing ecstasy as feeling returned to his flesh. With a Herculean effort, he pressed his head against the stone and struggled to his knees. He blinked the blood from his eyes and looked out through the slit in the plastic across his face. There in front of him was the killer, his childhood terror. He stood with his back to Simon, his massive form hunched over, as he slowly strangled Steve. Simon could hear the coarse decline of Steve's last breaths, and in the background the insistent whine of the electric pump that sucked in vain at the punctured bag. Simon swayed unsteadily, struggling to keep his balance, but then he drew a breath and focused his mind. Lucifer raised his head as the pump cut out, the familiar, discordant noise fading away to silence.
"No matter," he thought.
The witness should be dead by now, and the infuriating angel was soon to follow. He looked away and bent once more to the task of killing.
"No!"
the voice echoed loudly in his mind. Lucifer paused to listen. If this were the chorus speaking, then it was louder and clearer than it had ever been before. Maybe those in dominion had deigned to speak to him at last, in recognition of this, his greatest conquest.
"No!"
Lucifer froze. The voice was not in his mind. It was coming from behind him. He felt a strange and unnerving emotion, an alien sense of fear. With uncharacteristic trepidation, he relaxed his grip on the angel and turned to look back over his shoulder. The witness was alive.
He knelt there, like an apparition of death, the ghost of all his victims kneeling before the altar, looking at him with eyes he had never noticed before, grey eyes staring out through the blood-smeared plastic. They were the eyes of vengeance, the eyes of wrath, and Lucifer was afraid. But his fear quickly turned to fury. Lucifer let the angel fall. He turned to face the witness. His lip curled in an animal snarl, and he started forward, the rod raised high in the air. He would kill him. He would crush him. He would tear his body apart with his own bare hands. He would rend him asunder, and then he would burn his remains until nothing remained but ash. Lucifer reared up over the witness, and the rod began to fall. No! The voice was like a thunderclap in Lucifer's mind, and the rod went flying from his grasp. It tumbled through the air, clattering and clanging against the wall of the chapel. What was this new manifestation of evil? Lucifer looked down at the witness. A fire burned in those stone-grey eyes. He must quench it, snuff it out. He reached out with his massive hands. Silence the witness. Cut out his tongue. Fill his mouth with dirt. No! The invisible force struck Lucifer in the chest and sent him reeling back. He stumbled over the body of the angel and almost lost his footing. He looked up at the shrouded form of the witness, hunched and kneeling on the floor. He looked into the face of death and was afraid. And he faced his fear in the only way that he knew how, with violence and with hate. Lucifer charged forward like a raging bull, but the invisible force struck him again. It lifted him from his feet and propelled him through the air. It slammed him back against the wall of the chapel and held him there, his feet flailing 6 feet from the floor.
Abomination! Screamed Lucifer,
straining to break free of the bonds that held him.
Spawn of iniquity!
Simon looked up at the killer, his eyes bored into him, holding him fast.
Blasphemer! Shouted Lucifer. Child of profanity, accursed witness, the chorus condemns thee. Thou art abhorrent to those in dominion, a stain upon the land. You must die, confess your sins and die.
Simon had heard enough. His eyes narrowed as he pressed the killer's face against the wall.
Foul malefactor, you cannot be allowed to live.
The killer's words became broken and strained as his great jaw was crushed against the stone. Saliva spilled from the corner of his misshapen mouth as Simon began to squeeze. The killer's curses turned to stifled moans, and his dark eyes rolled back in his head, but still Simon did not stop. He was determined to silence the vitriolic stream of hate.
Simon.
At first, Simon did not hear the soft, croaking voice.
Simon!
Steve crawled across the blood-stained floor until he knelt at Simon's side.
Simon!
He said again, reaching out a shaking hand.
Simon! Let him go!
For all that had happened, Steve could not bear the thought of Simon becoming a killer. He would not blame him if he did. No one could. But he knew that if he did, Simon would be forever changed, diminished, tainted, changed.
Simon, let him go.
Finally, the fire went out of Simon's eyes, and with a great shuddering sob, he lowered his gaze, and the killer dropped heavily to the floor. Steve knelt up beside Simon and took hold of the bag. He hooked his fingers into the tear that he'd made and tore it back from Simon's head. Simon turned his wretched face to Steve, his eyes brimming with tears. For a moment, they just looked at each other. Then, in a voice of terrible sadness, Simon spoke. He was just a man, he whispered, the blood still running from his severed lip. All this time, just a man. Steve just nodded, clenching his jaw in the face of Simon's distress. All those people, said Simon, the sobs welling up in his chest. I know, said Steve. All those people who died here because I know, said Steve, I know. Steve reached for Simon. He took his head in his hands and looked at him intently. It's not your fault, he said. But Simon's eyes were unconvinced. Steve pulled Simon towards him and held him like a child against his chest. It's not your fault, he said, his own voice breaking with emotion. Simon was still naked, still bleeding, and still bound in a grotesque and filthy plastic bag. But there were things of more importance here, and so he held him while he cried. He was still holding him some minutes later when the distant whine of police sirens sounded in the night, and still yet when the cars skidded to a halt outside. It did not take them long to find them. The police entered the chapel cautiously, not knowing what they would find. But whatever they might have anticipated fell well short of what they saw. The members of the armed response team came first, moving with disciplined precision as they secured the room. They identified Simon and Steve and went to check the body at the base of the wall. One of the officers covered the enormous man with his firearm while the other bent to check him. Steve turned to watch. The police officer put two fingers against the killer's neck, then jumped back as the hulk of a man let out a moan and made to rise. But nothing of his great strength remained, and the officers subdued him with ease. You didn't kill him, said Steve, easing back from Simon. Simon did not look at Steve at first. He just stared across at the large figure, dressed in altar clothes and lying prostrate on the floor. I just cut off the blood supply to his brain, said Simon, glancing briefly up at Steve, and damn it all if he did not smile. Steve looked down at Simon, a strange sense of pride surging in his chest. God, but if ever he had a son. Sitting in the back door of the ambulance, Steve dabbed at his mouth and nose with a wad of sterile gauze, while the paramedic strapped up his chest. Simon was sleeping in the back of the ambulance. They had tended him with exquisite care, these people whose job it was to help the injured and the sick. They talked to him as they cleaned the muck and the blood from his body, never once hinting at embarrassment or disgust. They dressed his wounds, unwrapped his naked body in soft white blankets, and laid him down to sleep. And even then, they did not leave him. Steve looked up as a second ambulance drove off down the track, taking the killer away and out of their lives. How did you know? D.I. Regan was standing beside Steve at the back of the ambulance. He handed Steve a plastic cup of water as he too turned to watch the departing ambulance. It's not me, said Steve, nodding towards the sleeping figure behind him. It's him. What? Said D.I. Regan. You mean he really is psychic? Steve just nodded his head and sipped his water. He was starting to feel desperately tired. He felt like he could sleep for a week. My wife's cousin swears she's psychic, D.I. Regan went on. Makes a living from it and everything. Steve was barely listening. The paramedic tied off his bandage and helped him up into the ambulance. We always thought she was just nuts, said D.I. Regan, taking the cup of water back from Steve. She is, said Steve, as the paramedic ushered the inspector away from the ambulance and helped Steve up so that he could sit across from Simon. As Steve settled into the seat in the back of the ambulance, he looked down at the person lying opposite him. He still looked a frightful mess, but Simon was sleeping soundly, peacefully. Steve cast his mind back to the day that they'd met. A few short days that felt like a lifetime. I will pay you £3,000 a day if you will accompany me while I go about my business and keep me safe for the next 5 days. Steve wondered. If he could wind the clock back and, knowing what he knew, would he still take the money and take the job? He truly did not know. but in his mind he heard his father's voice, Geordie accent and all.
"Of course you would, soft lad, of course you would."
Not for the money, thought Steve, as he drifted off to sleep. No fucking way. But for the chance of knowing Simon and doing what he could. Perhaps, he thought, as sleep engulfed him. Perhaps. Chapter 33. Monday, March the 7th. Front page headline. Killer stopped after 14-year reign of terror. Richard Chatham put down the phone and sat back in his chair. Well, he thought, I wasn't expecting that. But then he'd not been expecting much of what had happened over the last few days. He steepled his fingers and tapped them lightly against his lips. Then he raised his eyebrows, blew out his cheeks, and smiled. Suppose I'd better go and tell the boss, he said quietly to himself. He started to rise from his chair. Then, no, sod it, he thought, with a new sense of liberation. I'll phone my wife first. Chapter 34. Tuesday, March the 8th. That your girlfriend again? Teased Steve, when Simon put away his mobile phone. I told you, said Simon with a smile. She's not my girlfriend. Well, you seem to get on very well, said Steve. Maybe you should ask her out to dinner. No need, said Simon. She's already asked me. Steve raised his eyebrows approvingly. There you go, you see, he said. Simon just shook his head and turned away, and Steve laughed at his coyness. Him and that mobile phone, he thought. What is more, the sister had told him off for using it. They interfere with the equipment, she'd told him. And you should be resting, she chided. You need your sleep. Sorry, sister, Simon had said like a naughty schoolboy who knew he would do it again the moment the teacher's back was turned. Steve was amazed at how quickly Simon had recovered from his ordeal. Not his body. The bruises, the burns, the neatly sewn up lip. All that would take weeks to heal, but his mind. After what he'd been through, Steve would have expected a severe degree of trauma. But Simon seemed almost cheerful. There was just the occasional moment when Steve caught him staring into space, the tears standing in his eyes. Steve knew that he did not cry for himself, but for the people who had gone before him, those who had died at the killer's hand. It's not your fault, Steve had told him again. I know, said Simon, but it feels like it is. You should be worried about yourself after what you've been through. Simon pursed his lips. After so many years living with fear, he said, it's a relief to be free of it. So, no more visions of death? Oh, said Simon, I have a new vision of my death. Steve looked sharply up at him. You know how you die, he asked him, and that doesn't frighten you? Simon shook his head. No, he said. It's sad. Not what I might choose, but it's a normal death, and I can live with that. Steve just looked at him, wondering at what kind of strength it took to live with what he knew. They'd remained in hospital for the rest of the day and a second night. But for all the unpleasantness, their injuries were largely superficial, and there was no reason for them to remain. Now they sat to the side of the BBC studio, while people bustled all around them, preparing for the press conference that was scheduled to go out just before the evening news. You needn't have come, said Simon, as they sipped their BBC coffee. Steve did his best to sound insulted. And miss your moment of glory, he said. I didn't pay you for an extra day, said Simon. Let's just say this one's on the house, said Steve, although both men knew that Steve was there because he wanted to be. He knew that he would soon be passing Simon over into someone else's care, but for now he felt that his duty was not over. Indeed, he did not want it to be over, not quite yet. He longed to get back to his family, but he had the rest of his life for them. He could spare another day.
They sat in silence for a while, watching the journalists fill up the seats in front of the stage. Most of the world's major news networks were present, but none of them showed any great enthusiasm at being there. Indeed, they seemed puzzled and annoyed that they'd been told so little about what to expect. Despite the impressive array of journalists, the press conference had not been widely publicized, and, with the exception of senior production staff, no one even knew what it was about. All that was about to change. "O ye of little faith," thought Steve. He watched them frown and humph as they wondered if it was worth their while being here at all. But Steve suspected that their irritation would not last for long. Another minute or so and two men were shown into the studio. One, a tall man with sandy hair and glasses, the other an older man, bald glasses and a bushy, stark white beard. The assistant directed the white-haired man to a chair on the stage. The other man was invited to take a chair to one side, where, like Steve, he could watch the proceedings, but would play no part in them. However, as the two men looked around the studio, they caught sight of Simon and Steve, and came across to speak with them. "Simon," said the white-haired man, waving Simon down when he made to stand. "Mr. Randy," said Simon, looking up at the elderly man, "thank you for coming." James Randy laughed, his sharp eyes sparkling. "Like you could have kept me away," he said. He reached down to shake Simon's hand warmly. "Thank you for the invitation," he said. "You're welcome," said Simon. Randy looked at Simon a moment longer. Then he patted his hand and turned to Steve. "Mr. Brannis," he said, extending his hand. "Mr. Randy," said Steve. "Jeff," he added, turning to shake the hand of Jeff Wagg, the manager from the Randy Foundation. "I hear you're quite the hero," said Randy, without any hint of cynicism. Steve blushed and started to object, but Randy just smiled. "I think they're nearly ready for us," he said as the studio assistants began to look in their direction. Simon started to rise from his chair, reaching for the walking stick that lay against it. "If you'll allow me," said Randy, extending his arm for Simon to take. Simon glanced down at Steve. "Go get 'em, psych boy," said Steve with a smile, and Simon limped onto the stage and into the glare of the studio lights. As Simon made his way up onto the stage, Steve sighed and took out his mobile phone. He could put it off no longer. Indeed, he could not bear to put it off any longer. He would call Christine and tell her that he would be home tonight. "I'm sorry, sir," the studio assistant leaned across to Steve. "We're about to go on air. You'll have to go outside if you want to make a call." Steve raised his eyes and put away his phone. "Something important, Mr. Brannis?" Steve started at the sudden voice. "Mr. Chatham," he said, as the civil servant sat down beside him. No, he said, referring to the disallowed phone call then. Yes, he amended quickly. "It can wait another hour," he concluded, feeling flustered. Chatham just smiled. "Not started yet, then?" he asked. "No," said Steve. "They're just..." "What are you doing here?" he interrupted himself, feeling a familiar sense of suspicion at such unexpected events. "I'm here to start my new job," said Chatham. Steve looked none the wiser. "Simon asked me if I would consider managing his affairs," said Chatham. "His life is about to become considerably more complicated." "Simon offered you a job?" Steve felt surprised and strangely piqued. "He did. And you said yes?" "I did." Steve turned to look at Simon, who was being given some direction as to what was about to happen. "I hope you know what you're letting yourself in for," he said. "I haven't the faintest idea," said Chatham, cheerfully. Steve was about to speak again when the lights in the studio came up and the shouts rang out that they were ready to go on air. It did not appear to be going well, but Steve was not worried because whenever he looked across at him, Simon did not appear to be worried. They had introduced him as the world's first psychic, and most of the press agencies had reacted with predictable skepticism. Steve had just smiled. He knew they would be convinced.
They just had to ask the right questions. "So what makes you different from the thousands of other psychics in the world?" asked the man from Fox News. Simon just smiled and was about to speak when Randy leaned across.
"If I may," he asked,
and Simon responded with a nod. "What makes Simon different," said Randy, "is that he can do the things he says he can do. He's a genuine psychic." The journalists were paying attention now, but they were still far from convinced. "A few days ago," Randy went on, "Simon came to be tested at the James Randi Educational Foundation." He paused. "There, Simon was able to demonstrate his psychic abilities under carefully controlled conditions." The journalists began to frown. It was just starting to dawn on them that this just might be for real.
"Are we supposed to take your word for it?" asked one.
"You have any proof?" asked another.
"We have video evidence," said Randy.
"What psychic ability did he demonstrate?"
Randy looked at Simon, who gave him another small nod. He reached into the pocket of his waistcoat and pulled out a small glass tube that Steve instantly recognized. "This steel rod is sealed inside a glass tube." He held it up for all to see. Simon was able to bend a similar metal rod in a similar glass tube without touching it.
"Wouldn't it break the glass if the rod bent?" asked one of the journalists.
Randy nodded. Simon removed the rod from the tube with his mind before bending it into shape. Eyebrows went up, lips were pursed, but they still had no reason to believe.
"What shape did he bend it into?"
Randy smiled, and again he looked to Simon for consent. He reached once more into his pocket, only this time he pulled out a steel rod that had been formed into a perfect circle. Some of the journalists seemed impressed, but they would not be doing their job if they'd just left it there.
"How do we know this isn't just a setup, a publicity stunt?"
Randy inclined his head. In their position, he would suspect the same.
"What about a demonstration?"
The suggestion came from the back of the room and was quickly taken up by several others. The person chairing the press conference sat forward.
"I'm afraid we can't ask Simon to..."
"It's okay," said Simon, in that quiet, arresting tone of his. "If I were them, I would expect no less." The chairman sat back in his seat, the doubt written large across his face. "Mr. Randy, if I may," said Simon, coming out from behind the table. Randy placed the circle of steel in Simon's palm and smiled as if he were thoroughly enjoying this. Simon turned to the room full of journalists. "Mr. Tyler," he said to the man from Sky News, "if you could please hold this so that everyone can see it." The man from Sky News seemed surprised that Simon should know his name, but he was not about to miss the opportunity to raise the profile of his network. He jumped up and took the circle from Simon.
"It's okay," said Simon. "You can bring the cameras in."
It was clear that the floor staff had not expected a close-up demonstration. "The boys are natural," thought Steve with a smile. Simon waited until everything was ready and everyone was settled. He smiled slightly at the wall of rapt faces, then he glanced at the circle of steel. The room erupted in a collective gasp of astonishment. The Sky News man had flinched and almost dropped it when the metal began to change its shape. Now his hands shook as he tried to hold it steady for the cameras to get a good clear look. What had been a perfect circle was now a perfect square.
"Smart ass," thought Steve,
at Simon's use of the ancient metaphor for the impossible.
"Mr. Brennus."
Steve turned at the sudden voice beside him. One of the production staff was leaning down over the back of his chair.
"Your wife and daughter are outside,"
the young woman said, over the hubbub of excited voices in the room.
"Would you like me to show them in, or would you rather speak to them outside?"
"My wife and daughter?" said Steve, as if he did not understand what the woman had said.
"Yes," she said. "They're waiting outside. Would you like me to show them in?"
Steve had never felt so flustered, confused, and nervous in his entire life.
Yes, show them in, please."
He rose from his seat, and Chatham gave him a reassuring smile
as he moved to the side of the room, away from the lights and the intense interest that was now focused on the stage. He waited near the door while the studio assistant popped outside. His heart was hammering in his chest as he tried to think of what he was going to say. But then the door opened, and Christine and Sally were there. Steve glanced down at his little girl. Her eyes were still ringed with yellow bruising. He put a hand to his mouth as the tears sprang to his eyes. But then his wife came to him, wrapped her arms around him, and nothing else mattered. Not the money, not the business, not the pain in his broken ribs. All that mattered was his wife and his little girl. Steve crouched down and looked at Sally. He held out his hand to her, but still she hesitated. Christine reached back and put an encouraging hand on her shoulder. And finally, Sally moved. She threw herself at her daddy and melted against his chest. Steve held her, enfolded her in his great, strong arms. He buried his face against the soft skin of her neck and breathed in the smell of her hair. He did not speak. He could not speak. Finally, Sally pushed away from him.
"Did someone hurt you, Daddy?"
she asked, reaching out a slender little finger to trace the cuts and bruises on his face.
Yes, they did,
managed Steve, through the tightness in his throat.
Was that because you were naughty?
Steve looked puzzled. He glanced up at Christine.
She thinks you hit her because she was naughty,
said Christine, wiping the tears from her cheeks.
Oh, God,
said Steve with a shuddering gulp.
You shouldn't sneak about and listen to other people's conversations,
said Sally, looking down at her shoes. Steve was lost for words, but not for tears. He clasped his daughter to his chest, and when he could, he whispered to her. You were not naughty, darling, he said. You did nothing wrong. Daddy was naughty for losing his temper and hitting the door. He held Sally gently away from him, and he looked into her big green eyes. And I am sorry, he said. I am very, very sorry. Sally looked at him for a moment.
That's okay, Daddy, she said. It doesn't hurt any more.
Steve reached out to hold her some more. Then he stood to kiss his wife. I'm sorry, he said. I'm sorry for everything.
It's okay,
said Christine, putting her palm against his bruised face. No, it's not, said Steve. I left you with everything, with barely a word. Christine seemed puzzled.
Steve, it's okay.
No, he insisted. You had Sally to deal with, and Paul and the bank, the solicitors. Christine looked as if Steve had lost his senses. Have they been giving you a hard time?
No,
laughed Christine, as if nothing could be further from the truth. Now it was Steve's turn to look puzzled.
The bank phoned me last week to see if we still wanted the loan after making such a large deposit.
Steve frowned. Large deposit? He said, thinking that £15,000 did not seem that large.
Yes, said Christine. From America, some educational foundation or something.
Steve just looked at her as the penny dropped.
$1 million, said Christine excitedly. Steve, that's over £500,000.
Steve's voice seemed to have deserted him once more.
However did you wangle that one? Asked Christine. What's the interest like? When do we need to pay it back?
Steve did not answer at first. He just turned to look across the studio to the young man fielding the barrage of questions from overexcited journalists. And as he did so, Simon glanced up. Just for a second, he looked at Steve with his stone grey eyes, and then he nodded and smiled as if to say, You're welcome. I don't think we need to pay it back, said Steve, turning back to his wife.
What? Said Christine. I don't understand.
It's a long story, said Steve. I should have called to tell you what was going on. I shouldn't have just walked out like that.
But you didn't, said Christine. There were the flowers.
Flowers?
Yes,
said Christine, fishing inside her pocket for the note she'd kept.
And the Nemo toy for Sally.
Steve took the note and read it. Hi, darling. So very sorry for what happened.
Please tell Sally that it wasn't her fault and Daddy was very naughty for losing his temper. Just had a call from someone who could get us out of this mess we're in, but I need to go away for a few days. Don't try me on the mobile, the network doesn't cover this region. We'll be in touch when I can. See you a week on Tuesday. Love, Steve. P.S. Give Nemo a kiss for me. Even his signature was exactly right.
I was desperate to speak to you, Christine went on. But there were your texts and your colleague called to let us know you were okay.
My colleague? Said Steve.
Simon, said Christine. He called us several times.
Steve put a hand to his forehead.
He sounds like such a nice young man.
Steve turned once again to look at Simon on the stage. The press conference was being brought to a close. Simon was being ushered from the stage. Chatham stood beside him. Then the chairman addressed the room.
Thank you.
Thank you, he said, as he struggled to quieten the excitement in the room. That's all we have time for just now. There was a collective groan of disappointment from the world's press. You will have the chance for more questions in just over a week's time. The journalists simmered down a little at this. From here, Simon will be going to the research facility at Portland Down, where an international symposium has been convened to begin the study of his remarkable abilities. Steve felt a sudden wrench as he realized that Simon was moving out of his life.
"Who's that?"
asked Christine, as she stood with her arm around her husband. Steve lifted Sally so that she could see.
"That," he said, "is Simon."
"Your colleague?" said Christine in surprise. "The guy that's been calling us?"
"That's right," said Steve. "He's the one who arranged the money."
"But where are they taking him?"
asked Christine, as Simon was bustled from the room. "He's off to meet some of the top minds in the world," said Steve. "But don't worry, I'm sure you'll get a chance to thank him."
"Well, I can thank him a week on Friday," said Christine.
"What?" said Steve.
"I invited him to dinner," said Christine. "I was going to do lamb."
Steve just stared after Simon as he disappeared through the door at the far side of the studio.
"Who is he?" asked Christine.
For it was clear that Simon was more than just a colleague of Steve's.
"He's a psychic," said Steve.
"What?" said Christine. "A real psychic?"
"Yep," said Steve. "The first and only."
Epilogue. Friday, March the 18th.
"Stop fretting," said Steve, as he stood with Sally and Christine at the foot of their drive.
"But I'm nervous," said Christine. "He can read people's minds. What if I fancy him?"
Steve just laughed as the car pulled up beside them.
"How's it going, freak?" he said as Simon emerged from the back seat of the car. He crossed the pavement to greet his friend. "The men in white coats figured out what's wrong with you yet?"
Simon smiled as he took Steve's hand.
"Terminal case, I'm afraid."
Steve laughed. And after a brief, appraising look, the two men embraced and held each other tight.
"It's good to see you looking so well," said Steve, as two young boys ran up to them.
"Are you the psychic man?"
one of them asked. Simon and Steve exchanged a look of amusement.
"Yes, I am," said Simon.
"Told you,"
said one of the boys.
"Can we have your autograph?"
said the other. Simon looked embarrassed, but Steve just laughed.
"You've only got yourself to blame," he said.
Simon looked round for something to write with, then turned as the driver's window of the car slid down.
"Thanks, Ben," he said, as the driver held out a pen and a piece of paper.
He leaned on the car to sign the piece of paper.
"And yours too,"
said one of the boys, looking up at Steve.
"You're the one who caught that killer, the SAS man."
Steve blushed and Christine's eyes shone as she smiled at her husband's discomfiture. Steve took the paper from Simon and was about to sign it when he stopped and paused, looking at Simon's name as he had written it on the page. "To Max and Stuart, from Simon, the world's first psychic."
"What's the matter?"
asked Simon, as Steve continued to stare at the paper.
"Nothing," said Steve.
He added his name to the paper and handed it back to the excited boys.
It's just that I...
"What?"
said Simon, as they turned towards the house. Not imagining things that aren't there, are we? Christine linked her arm into Simon's, and Sally held his hand. But Simon glanced back at Steve. Maybe there's something of the psychic in all of... Don't give me that bollocks, said Steve, cuffing Simon smartly round the back of the head. You're the only psychic in the world, thank God. Simon laughed as he was escorted up the drive. Steve followed close behind, and as they stepped through the door, he heard Sally's voice.
How did you hurt your face? She asked.
Your daddy cut me with a knife.
Did he really?
Asked Sally, as if Simon were teasing her. Yes, he did, the nasty brute, said Simon with a smile. He really did.